So this is pretty much the dream team panel, with one exception for which I have to apologize. Tom Schelling, my teacher, had promised to be here. He was actually originally supposed to chair this panel, and then when he heard what John was going to talk about, he asked to become a commentator instead because he thought he had some interesting things to say, and I was looking forward to that. One of the things I'm most proud of is that Tom did in fact serve on my dissertation committee. And of course, it's every student's dream to surpass a teacher, but if your teacher's Tom Schelling, you just give up on that in a hurry. So the next best ambition is to have a student who's way better than you are. Another thing that I'm very proud of is that I served on John Calkins' dissertation committee, and I was really looking forward to being able to point out to Tom that you know, there aren't many things I do better than he does, but my student can think rings around his. And then Tom fell and broke a hip and a wrist. Alice assures me that the doctors are optimistic, that Tom is bearing up, that he'll be back with us, but at 93, that's not something you travel after. So he will not be able to join us. But we were fortunate that Wayne Hall was available. So we have not lost quality at all. So John Calkins, Stever Professor of Operations Research at Carnegie Mellon University, is going to talk to us about cannabis as a temptation good. And then we're going to get comments from Wayne Hall, from Rob McCoon, and from David Cordray. John, take it away.
So I trust the slides will come up at some point. Thank you for that kind introduction, Mark, and for the opportunity to speak at all. I must confess, this is a pretty intimidating talk to give because almost everything that I think I know about drug policy I've learned from people who are already in the room, but I will try to say something novel. But I'm not going to talk about whether we should legalize drugs, and I'm not going to talk about how legalization to date has turned out for reasons that will become clear, I think. Instead, I'm going to talk about how to legalize marijuana, assuming that we're going to go down that path. And I'm going to give you the punchline up front, and then the talk will back it up. And the punchline is, I think we are going, in the United States, to legalize marijuana nationally and roughly along the alcohol model. And I think there's a very good chance that 25 years, 40 years from now, the public health community, and indeed a big chunk of the public in general, is going to look back at those of us living in 2016, shake their heads and ask, what were you thinking? Why on earth did you think it was a good idea to create an industry full of corporate titans that promote frequent use of another dependence-inducing intoxicant, and do so with the marketing savvy and clout in the political regime of Budweiser and the ethics of big tobacco? I view this talk as the fourth in a line of papers where I've raised this concern about the corporate model of legalizing marijuana. Thanks. In 2014, I wrote a piece in Washington Monthly where I suggested that it would be better for nonprofit organizations to be the ones who produce and distribute and who are charged with merely meeting existing demand to undercut the black market and not promoting additional demand. Last year, along with a bunch of co-authors through RAND, many of whom are here, I wrote a report for the state of Vermont that laid out the full spectrum of options. If you put extreme prohibition at this end and pure libertarian at the other end, there are steps like legalizing home growing and cannabis clubs that are only coming in a few steps. And the alcohol model is at the other end. And we are flying by quite a few intermediate models that might protect us from some of the downsides of the corporate approach. Earlier this year at the London School of Economics, I more or less conceived corporate approach, but said that there is an opportunity to stack the deck in favor of protecting against the downsides by choosing an aggressive regulatory agency. I said there are really four main interest groups involved. There's the industry itself, there's government's interest in economic development and tax revenue. There are the great majority of cannabis users who are by and large happy and not harmed by their use, and then there's the much smaller number of people who have lost control of their use and are harmed by it. And that last group consumes the great bulk of the marijuana and is the source of the great bulk of the industry's profits. And by the way, they tend to be less educated and poor and less politically powerful even per person. So the first three groups' interests align in favoring lenient regulations, easy access, product variety, and promotion. In industry and the casual users' interests align in favoring low taxes. It's only this smaller, politically weaker group whose interests are the opposite. And I suggested that it would be good if at the moment of legalization, before the industry is already politically powerful, and in that brief moment when busy politicians are focused on the issue, if we stack the deck in favor of a regulatory agency that would defend this last and vulnerable group against industry, because industry's interest is in trying to promote more and more use for those heavy users. Now today I'm going to retreat one step farther. You can call me a product of my generation or the times, but I really don't believe that government works for the public welfare. I believe it is more likely to cozy up to industry than to tame industry's bad impulses. Now, I will grant that the FDA vis-a-vis the tobacco industry is a model, but I think it's the exception that proves the rule. When I look across banking, airlines, alcohol, pharmaceuticals, and other sectors, I do not see great evidence of a highly competent government actively defending the vulnerable against corporate interest. So today I'm going to explore the idea of a different sort of break that might slow down corporate-driven promotion of problem use after legalization, and that is the idea to reconceptualize marijuana, a little bit, as Mark said, not as the demon drug or the symbol of peace and progressive politics or the embodiment of generational conflict or a miracle cure for everything from Alzheimer's to Zika, but as what I will suggest as a temptation good, a product or service that belongs in the category not with cocaine and heroin, but with gambling, prostitution, pornography, video games, sugary sodas, donuts. An indulgence that is not dangerous in moderation, but that the moralists are correct to caution us can easily get out of control. And that we as a society would be better off if we recognized marijuana as such. As we're removing the physical barriers that protect us from temptation, we need to replace them with informal social norms that will protect those who would be vulnerable from excess. So that's the punchline. Now I'll try to deliver the talk. First, some just definitions issues. There are many things that are wrapped up in conversations about legalization that are not legalization, things like eliminating mandatory minimum sentences. I'm not going to talk about that. They're not legalization. There are also, as I mentioned, many kinds of legalization. There we go. I guess that's... That's not so good. That's good. There are also many different kinds of legalization. As I suggested, I think some of them are very good, but I'm skipping past them for the simple reason that all four states that have legalized recreational marijuana use in the United States have also legalized large-scale production by for-profit corporations. Now, it is also true that no nation has yet legalized marijuana in this sense of the term. And let me repeat this because I think it's very important. Legalization for non-medical use in the United States today is about allowing large-scale production and promotion by for-profit corporations. We're headed in that direction, but neither the United States nor any other country has gotten there yet. Uruguay so far has only deployed home-growing in cannabis clubs. Those are sort of old hat in compared to places like Spain. Even what they will start to do in the the summer, which will be large scale, is still under government control. So we're talking about, or I'm talking today about something that has not happened yet, but I think it is going to happen. And I'm going to try to justify that with some maps, because I've learned that you can't give a talk about marijuana legalization without maps. This is the industry's map. It shows that there are just a handful of holdout states in red, red being the universal color of danger. These are the pig-headed moralistic holdouts that don't see the virtues of the triumph of the 21st century's most important expansion of human rights and civil liberties. This is Wikipedia's view, and we all know that you can't trust Wikipedia, you can't cite it in academic work, and certainly can't bring it into a plenary talk. However, I think this complexity, even if some of the details are wrong, better captures the reality than that previous slide's sort of black and white or red and green view. If I look just at medical, this map splits out CBD medical from THC medical, and you see that a big chunk of the country that is no longer red, supposedly, has legalized CBD. But CBD is not intoxicating, not dependence-inducing, and it's not even prohibited. If you do a word search on the Controlled Substances Act, it does not exist there. Even within these regimes, there's variety, though. In Georgia and Virginia's CBD-only laws do allow up to 5% THC, not just the 0.5% of the other states. And it's worth noting that 5% is higher than the average THC of all the cannabis the government seized up through 2000. And on the THC medical marijuana states, there's also enormous variety out there. Minnesota's is not like California's. But I think what we should really focus on is not the medical map, but the map of legalizing for recreational use. And here what you see is that so far it's just four states, and they are essentially the four most isolated states in the country. And that matters because marijuana flows across state borders. I know that's a shocker. I think we think that it flows across international borders fine, but we've somehow constructed the idea that we can have a laboratory of 50 independent states each doing their own thing. But that's not the case. The value to weight ratio of marijuana ensures that it will flow across state borders. One of the things I like to remind people is that a year's worth of marijuana for a heavy user weighs less than this one bottle of Diet Coke. We are beginning to see those flows. We haven't seen them completely just because the industry is still just getting started. Those flows across state borders will soon become more important. The map also shows the places where we expect legalization to be pursued later this year. They include very big states like California, a country unto itself. They include small states in the center of the population in the eastern part of the United States. When we did the report for Vermont, it noted that there are 40 times as many marijuana users near Vermont, but outside its borders, as there are inside Vermont. So this current map is not stable. There is, I suppose, some chance the genie could go back in the bottle. I doubt it. But we will not stop with just four states or seven states. Once your neighbor has legalized, that undercuts all the benefits of prohibition without giving you any of the benefits of legalization. So we are on a pathway that's going to go towards nationwide, or maybe a few holdouts, legalization of cannabis. And it doesn't mean it's going to be uniform everywhere. I mean, here's a map of alcohol. There are some states that involve the government in control of the distribution, particularly of spirits. My state's one of the few that has the government involved beyond just hard spirits, and Pennsylvania will probably drop its control regime soon. And there's even outright prohibition at the county level. The red dots are the counties that are dry. The yellow are the counties that have towns in them that are dry. I used to live in a dry city outside of Pittsburgh. It has since stopped being dry because it wanted the economic benefits of being able to host the bars instead of having their citizens go across borders. And beyond just outright control, you can ask questions like, can you buy alcohol on a Sunday? Depends where you live. Can you consume alcohol walking down the street? That also depends on where you live. So I'm not suggesting that we are going to have uniform marijuana legalization around the country, but I do think that we will have the marijuana equivalent of this last map, which shows the state taxes that's the state taxes on beer. And the first point is that every single state has a tax on beer, because in every single state, anybody over the age of 21 can buy beer, and basically anybody over the age of 16 can get it, even though they can't buy it directly. And the second point is that Tennessee really stands out here for having by far the highest tax at 66 cents a six-pack, 11 cents a can, and the vast majority of the country has much lower taxes than that. And this is, I think, where we're going with marijuana. Nationwide, there will be variation on things like whether you can have dabs and regulations over edibles, but everywhere there will be availability for purchase by people 21 and over at low prices, basic marijuana. So if that's where we're headed in terms of policy, then the next question is, what does that imply in terms of marijuana use, abuse independence, tax revenues, job creation, and so on? What will the world look like when there's a Budweiser for marijuana buds? And Peter Reuter and Rob McCoon tried to answer that question some time ago with their wonderful book, Drug War of Heresies, but in 2001, they only had one data point of legalization to work with, and that was the Dutch coffee shop regime. So at that point, learning from other times, places, and vices left them understandably fairly agnostic as to what would happen if our country moved all the way across the horizontal axis to full legalization. It's hard to draw a regression line through just one point. Now, today, we have many more data points, so there is some optimism that we ought to be able to project the consequences of full legalization better, but I think this is the picture of where we are today. Yes, there are more data points, but they are still clustered at the left-hand side, where it's essentially close to full prohibition. No nation has legalized nationwide alcohol model yet, and that federal prohibition matters. You'll hear a lot in the next couple days about things like tax implications of 280E, lack of access to banking services, but more fundamentally, big tobacco companies and the big alcohol companies do not get into this industry yet because it is still federally banned. For that matter, honest to goodness, black dirt Iowa farmers are not out there competing in this industry yet, but they will. And even after national legalization, it will take decades, not just 2 years, to see the full effect. So I think we should think about national legalization as like a radical technological innovation that drives down the production cost and also other aspects of the industry. But on the production costs, this is what's happening with prices in Washington state. Market declines, even after it seems like it's somewhat plateauing, those are still declines of 25% per year. And if you try to build models of what the industry's cost structure will look like under different regimes, you get pictures that look like this. On the far left is the farm gate price under full prohibition of a pound of high quality marijuana. The next three bars are the situation just before Colorado and Washington legalized, the sort of gray, nebulous medical marijuana regime. There's a bar out there for medical marijuana in the Netherlands, fully legal but does not achieve economies of scale and is highly regulated. And as you move further across, it's what you can anticipate the production cost structure to look like after national legalization, when it's just going to be farmed the same way that tomatoes and cucumbers are. But the legalization is going to be impactful not only on production costs, it's also going to affect industry structure, the size of firms, their operating practices. So to appreciate that, I want you to think for a minute about how well you could have predicted the impact of aviation on American society in 1905, 2 years after Orville and Wilbur Wright's flight, 2 years after the stores opened in Colorado and Washington, or how well could you have predicted the information revolution in 1956, 2 years after the invention of the silicon transistor? Now you might say those are really true technological innovations. That's not a fair comparison, but a closer comparison might be the invention of machine-rolled cigarettes in the late 19th century. Cigarettes had been around for a long time before that, but the industry really took off when the machine rolling radically reduced the labor necessary to create a cigarette, and consumption grew spectacularly after that. But you could say some of that wasn't directly the result of the machine-rolled cigarettes. In the 1920s and 1930s, the great big tobacco companies, in search of greater profits, aggressively marketed to women who had not at that point become a large market for cigarettes. And I would say, yeah, that's right, it's not directly the result of the invention of the machine-rolled cigarette, but it is indirectly the result of it. Why were the corporations out there trying to create new markets? Because that's what for-profit corporations do. Why were there big for-profit corporations? Because machine rolling created economies of scale that led to bigger firms. And as production costs went down, the key to success became more about marketing, not just production. And there are many industries that you can do this. I lived for a while in the Middle East. Life in deserts has been radically transformed by reverse osmosis desalination. The old thermal approach to desalination was very expensive. The curve in the upper left shows the decline in the cost of desalination. The curve on the right shows the increase in the use of it. Another comparison might be deregulation of the railroad industry. And these graphs are on different time scales, but I tried to line them off so that just past halfway is the moment of deregulation of railroads. The bottom graph shows the amount of railroad freight, and it was basically flat throughout the whole post-World War II period until deregulation. Top graph shows how that cut prices and led also to an increase in use. Same kind of story for wind power generation. This is a combination of technological innovations, not just one, but it shows the same pattern of big increases in use. So I think that we should expect that legalization will greatly increase use. I don't know how much. In fact, with some people in this room, have you written papers that said, we cannot know how much, but for purpose of this talk, let's just suppose it's a doubling. And a doubling is not crazy. Consumption of marijuana in the United States has already doubled between 2004 and 2014 during the period of liberalizing medical use, so a further doubling seems entirely plausible. What does that mean? Well, it depends on where we are today, and this is the five-line derivation of the cannabis market in the United States. Along with Rand colleagues, we managed to write 400-page reports that basically find the same thing. Americans willingly self-report 328 million past month days of use in household surveys, multiplied by 12, that's one of those fancy RAND mathematical techniques, and you get to 4 billion days of use in the year, fudge up by maybe 25% because there's a little bit of underreporting in surveys, multiply by 1.3 grams per day of use, which is the average, and you get 6,500 metric tons. And that's probably the average price, about $7 a gram, because this is a mix of the commercial grade and the high quality. So that's sort of what the market looks like. But it is Sunday morning, and we are in a country that doesn't speak metric. So I think a better way to think about this is in hours of intoxication. So take the 6,500 metric tons, divide it by 0.4 grams per joint, multiply by 2.5 hours of intoxication per joint, and you've got 40 billion hours of intoxication today, and so a doubling of consumption would mean an additional 40 billion hours. Now, some of you might be saying, it's 2.5 hours, it's not that long, but I do want to note, this is one person consumes the entire joint, and it would work out to having about 40 milligrams of THC. This is a straight lab study of what happens when you give people 40 milligrams of THC, 45 actually, the triangles. Their perceptions of intoxication and impairment for driving purposes. All I want you to see in this graph, and I know it's hard to read, is that the horizontal axis is measured in hours. So it is not crazy to think that a joint consumed by a single person when it's reasonably high potency can produce 2.5 hours of influence. Maybe intoxication isn't the word you want to use, but it's the acute consequences of recent consumption, whatever we want to call that. And so my first major point is that that consequence of marijuana legalization is by far the most important marijuana-specific consequence of legalization. There may be indirect effects on alcohol. There may be indirect effects on tobacco smoking that are more important. But if we are looking at marijuana-specific effects, the change in consumption is the most important consequence. I mean, some of you are saying, oh, no, getting all those nonviolent marijuana offenders out of prison, that's the big deal. No, it's not. 30 or 40,000 marijuana offenders in prison times $40,000 per cell a year, that's like $1.5 billion. That's nothing compared to 40 billion hours. The valuation of an hour of marijuana intoxication is hard to work out even here so close to Wall Street. The Wall Street Journal doesn't cite a market rate for an hour of intoxication, but I would suggest it's on the order of $1 or $5 an hour. Now, I don't know whether it's positive or negative, but I think it's on that order. And $5 an hour times 40 billion hours, 200 billion, is way bigger than $1.5 billion associated with incarceration. And I do think that the people who dislike marijuana use would view the cost at $1 an hour or a few dollars an hour. And conversely, the people who think that marijuana use is wonderful and a source of pleasure and entertainment would value it at $1 or $5 an hour. That is what we pay, or less than what we pay to go to the movies. So even modest valuations on intoxication times 40 billion hours of intoxication swamps the outcome of nobody in prison. It swamps the outcome of fewer arrests. 700,000 arrests times, pick your number, $2,000, $3,000 per arrest, that's still in the $1.5, $2 billion range. Fewer zeros than this effect. Some of you are interested in the health consequences. Marijuana legalization will lead to greater demands on the treatment system. Yes, but if we double the number of treatments, they have 300,000 extra treatments a year at $3,000 a piece, that's not even a billion. That's fewer zeros. The real marijuana-specific consequence of legalization is going to be an increase in use. People who like marijuana use should like marijuana legalization. People who don't should not. So this raises the question of what is the use like that is going to be going up? So I am a professor, as Mark said, so I have to give a quiz to make sure everybody's still awake, and here is the quiz. What proportion of the American marijuana market is accounted for by adults with no abuse or dependence problem and who use on fewer than 10 days a month? That last line is odd. Let me explain it. What I'm trying to do is adults with no abuse or dependence problem who only use on weekends, so they're not using on days when they work, but I don't know which day of the week they use. So less than 10 days a month is my proxy for not using on work days. And I am fairly serious. I would like you all to either write it down or whisper it to the person next to you, but commit yourself to what do you think that number is. I hate it when there are smart grand people in the audience. All right, Grizzly, here's the answer. You stole my punchline. That one-third of marijuana users consumes 2% of the marijuana. 2%. Adults with no abuse or dependence problem who are using every weekend day or less often are utterly irrelevant for the industry. 2% of the market. Because daily and near daily users absolutely dominate consumption. This is a graph many of you have probably seen before. The bottom of the bars in dark, that's daily users, then the little stripes above it are near daily, 21 or more days a month. Looking at the far left column, they are only 1 in 5 people who use marijuana. Moving over a column, they're 1 in 3 past month users. Move over another column, they are 2 out of 3 days of use, but they also use more grams per day of use. The far right-hand column, more than 80% of the consumption. If you look just at the black bar on the far right, people who say they use every single day consume more than 50% of the marijuana in the United States. In a very literal sense, more than half the marijuana consumed in the United States is consumed by people who spend more than half of their waking hours under the influence of marijuana. And that is because of a spectacular increase in daily and near daily use. It has grown by a factor of 8 over the last generation. Back in 1992, alcohol utterly dominated marijuana. Top line alcohol, bottom line marijuana. In 1992, there were fully 10 times as many daily or near daily alcohol users as marijuana users in the United States. But the pattern of marijuana use has changed. It's gone from being like alcohol, 1 in 10 used daily or near daily, to now nearly 40%. It's moving to being used more like tobacco. Now the ratio of alcohol to marijuana daily and near daily use has fallen below 2 to 1. So one way to get your head around what the market is like is half of it is by people who have an abuse or dependence problem or who have been in treatment in the past on something. So this includes alcoholics' use of marijuana. And the other half is adults who don't report enough problems in surveys to qualify for DSM-IV definitions of abuse or dependence. The kids who are not daily users are not a big part of the story. And if we slice this more finely to factor in the frequency of use, then that left-hand half splits out like this. Only that very thin wedge at the top are those less than 10-day-a-month adult users. The great bulk of the wedge that's not abuse or dependence is daily or near-daily use. So as we look forward to this increase of 40 billion or so hours of additional intoxication, we really have to think hard about that last piece. Presumably, most of us would agree that the right-hand half is not bringing joy and happiness. When people with a medically diagnosable abuse and dependence problem are using more intoxicants, it's not usually seen as a triumph. The left-hand side, what about the people who use daily or near daily but say they have no problems? What we hope is that they're going to be like the caffeine consumers in this comic. The guy says, I usually start my day with 2 cups of espresso, 4 cans of Red Bull, and a Jolt Coke. Some days that just isn't enough. Tolerance can be very great, and apparently, you know, these people are still successful. They're still wearing ties. They're still showing up to work. So hopefully, marijuana legalization will bring a lot more daily and near-daily use like that. And to illustrate the extent to which tolerance may help protect, let me show you the 2 graphs that are admittedly a little bit hard to read, especially if I can't get them to show at all. There we go. Now, this is a graph for occasional marijuana users who were exposed to a dose of THC at time zero in the middle, and you see the THC soars up and then comes rapidly crashing back down. THC doesn't stay in the bloodstream long, which is why it doesn't correlate with any sort of impairment. The other 2 lines that stay high for hours are intoxication, good, they're happy, and confusion, bad, they're not going to function as well. For the inexperienced users, the 2 lines that persist for hours persist in almost the same way. The same study did the exact same thing for experienced users. And then just to wake you up on Sunday morning, it actually presented it in mirror image. So now dropping down a long ways is a big positive effect. And again, you see that there's a very sharp spike in THC after you take marijuana. No shock, no surprise there. And the THC goes away very quickly. The intoxication line persists for hours. It doesn't persist quite as long as for occasional users, but it does persist. But the confusion line does not. In fact, the confusion line never really moves off zero. So at least with respect to those 2 particular outcomes, you have what you're hoping for. Lots of fun, no harm. I absolutely grant that there are hundreds of thousands of people who can hold their THC just as there are many alcoholics who can hold their alcohol very well. I am worried, though, that there are also going to be hundreds of thousands of people in the legalization regime who use daily and near daily less successfully than that graph implies. You can call me a pessimist, you can call me a worrier, maybe you can call me a parent of teenagers. And I do want to tell a little story about my 3 teenagers, because I'm a parent, that maybe bears on my views on this. And it has to do with drug testing and competitive interscholastic events. My daughter is an athlete. athlete. She's in track, pole vault, javelin, shot put. She's never yet been drug tested for steroids, but that's just because she's only in ninth grade. I presume that if she progresses to higher levels of competition, she will be drug tested, and that makes perfect sense. Because steroids truly are a performance-enhancing drug when it comes to athletic performance, and her team would have an unfair advantage if her coach was slipping her steroids and the other team didn't get them. My sons competed in the chess team and the debate team. Neither of them were drug tested, even though they are older and progressed to more advanced levels of competition. Apparently, the other team wasn't worried that Jay's chess coach was slipping him cannabis to help him plot more moves in ahead in the chess game. And apparently, Joseph's debate coach, no one had to worry that she was slipping him cannabis to help him be able to concisely articulate the analytic points with which he tried to win the debate. And, you know, there's this sense of, this is silly. And that's right. It's silly because steroids are a performance-enhancing drug for physical activities. Marijuana is not a performance-enhancing drug for intellectual activities. It is a performance-degrading drug, at least in terms of acute intoxication. I'm not talking here about 20 years later a change in IQ. I'm just talking about while you're under the influence. And remember, more than half of the cannabis is consumed by people who spend more than half of their waking hours under the influence. So I do worry about this increase in use inevitably being an increase in daily use. But I do note that this is a very different worry than for the other illegal drugs, or for that matter, the legal drugs. Because it's an internality, it's an impact on the user, not on anyone else. Alcohol does hurt alcohol users, but it has a lot of externalities, violence, traffic crashes. So there's a public interest in trying to reduce alcohol use. Cocaine, crack, meth, the powerful stimulants, they harm the user, they create externalities. But the big thing that's scary about them is an internality, which Mark has called a behavioral toxicity. You hear these stories, presumably apocryphal, of the mom who sells her baby to get money to buy crack. And the progressive response to that is, we'll legalize crack because then it would be cheap. But the conservative response is to worry a little bit when a consumer good becomes so compelling that a parent could value it more than a kid. And so we do still, I think, plan to continue to control those. Heroin is mostly about internalities. Illegal heroin creates externalities like crime, but if we legalized heroin, it would mostly be internalities. It would mostly just be harming the users, but in a particularly dramatic way. It could kill them immediately from overdose. And from a libertarian perspective, you could say, who cares? People should be able to kill themselves. But as a practical matter, society, I think, continues to think that opiates should be controlled. Tobacco is a little bit like heroin. Yeah, secondhand smoke is unhealthy for other people, so there's an externality. But the biggest impacts of tobacco use are on the smoker, and they are medical. They are emphysema, lung cancer, death, albeit in the long run, and so on. Marijuana's got none of that. Marijuana is not killing people. It's not creating much in the way of externalities. It's mostly creating internalities, and they are not medical internalities, certainly not death. So even if illegal marijuana has traditionally been put on this slide and compared to those things, what I'm suggesting today is that legal marijuana needs instead to be thought of on this slide with these things that I call temptation goods. Some of which are morally laden, prostitution, gambling, and lottery tickets, and I think marijuana will continue to be morally loaded for another 15 years. Some are just time sinks, like video games. We have two different families, friends of ours back in Pittsburgh, whose oldest sons are a year older than my oldest son, both of whom failed in college, fundamentally because they were unable to discipline themselves to not spend very many hours per day on video games once they had left the structured environment of their family of origin. And reality TV maybe is in there. Or we can compare it to consumables, because you do are consume it. So this is where soda, relevant in New York since they tried the soda tax here, donuts, death by chocolate cake. So what I'm I hear a particular laugh coming from one friend of mine for whom this may be a singular temptation. So my suggestion is that we think about legalized marijuana in this class of products and services, these temptation goods, that generate few direct tangible externalities, but with which the users have complex relationships, and those temptations can harm the minority of people who lose control. So I see I'm out of time. I will close with just a couple of quotes. Mae West said, "I generally avoid temptation unless I can't resist it." And there's an ancient wisdom, it's easier to avoid temptation than to resist it. By deciding to legalize corporate-produced cannabis, we are throwing out that old wisdom of protecting ourselves from being surrounded by temptation. The children of today are going to go through their adolescence and young adulthoods living in worlds where marijuana is cheap, ubiquitous, and heavily marketed. We've taken away the avoid temptation strategy, and I am suggesting that it is our obligation to construct informal social norms to take the place of those formal social controls that are being removed to try to protect them, the minority of them that might lose control. Most people can occasionally have death by chocolate cake without a problem, but obesity is a real issue in this country. Most people are very happy with their cannabis use, but I think there will be a substantial number of people who are going to be harmed by this corporate commercialized regime that we are creating. Thank you.